A Story Publishing presents Oxford, The Bridge of Time. At first light on the 1st of May, Magdalen Bridge belongs to voices. High above the gray spire, the college choir gathers, as it has for half a millennium, and lets ancient Latin roll out across the Thames, called the Isis here, toward meadows still blurred with mist. The notes drift downstream, over boathouses, where rowers will later chase one another, and upstream toward low walls that once marked a Roman roadway. In that suspended moment, the city folds its centuries like concertina paper, and listeners, tourists rubbing sleep from their eyes, scholars carrying bicycles, a few lingering revelers, stand quietly, unsure whether they are spectators of a ritual or temporary inheritors of something older than ritual itself. A king once paused on this very eastward approach. Henry II, riding from Woodstock in the summer of 1167, ordered his escort to rein their mounts so he could watch clerks in black gowns debating on the riverbank. He had just barred Englishmen from the University of Paris, a maneuver aimed at weakening his enemy, the Archbishop Thomas Becket. That single edict redirected the country's brightest minds to Oxford, and the king's brief halt foretold an unexpected consequence. A community of learning that would outlast monarchs, empires, even the concept of monarchy itself. 200 years later, Walter de Merton, Chancellor of England and sometime bishop, crossed the same bridge under a lowering sky. In his saddlebag, he carried parchment statutes that would found Merton College on perpetual revenues, the first legal guarantee that scholars might depend on more than the vagaries of a landlord. He could smell wet wool from the town's fullers as he entered the gates, yet what occupied him was stranger than any artisan's craft. The idea that knowledge needed bricks, rules, and common dining tables if it was to grow. Sir Thomas Bodley arrived by barge in 1598. Diplomacy in the Low Countries had taught him the value of reliable information. Here he found the university library dark, its chained manuscripts coated in dust. Standing inside the gloomy hall, he resolved to resurrect it, offering his fortune and his name, on condition that every printer in England send a copy of each new book. When the Bodleian reopened in 1602, students queued beside the same bridge to glimpse what seemed an inexhaustible universe of pages. 4 centuries compressed themselves into a laboratory bench when Dorothy Hodgkin, a demure woman with owlish glasses and X-ray plates tucked beneath her arm, bicycled across in wartime blackout. Rubber tires hissed on the wet stone, but her mind clattered with equations describing the angles of crystalline insulin. She would sketch them in chalk that night, and 2 decades later accept a Nobel Prize for showing the world the molecule that steadies human blood. And in early 2020, a quiet woman in a green parka hurried over the bridge toward the Jenner Institute. Professor Sarah Gilbert had just read the newly published genetic code of an unfamiliar coronavirus. By the time the May morning choir sang again, her team's vaccine prototype was already sliding into the first syringes of a clinical trial. Within a year, it would pulse through billions of bloodstreams, an unplanned benediction on an anxious planet. 5 figures. 5 crossings, 1 small bridge. The stones beneath their boots and hooves and bicycle tires are the same that bear today's visitors. They are also an index of a persistent question. How does a town whose population barely fills a modern football stadium keep reinventing the future? Geography offers partial answers, rivers for trade, a day's ride from London, yet far enough to think. But geography alone cannot explain the leap from horsehair scrolls to quantum algorithms. Nor can privilege. Oxford has survived royal confiscations, civil war sieges, fires, floods, and the periodic disgust of its own citizens. Something else, some alloy of curiosity, autonomy, and institutional memory, has allowed it to bend without breaking, to admit contradiction yet defend coherence. That alloy is the business of this book. Over the coming chapters, the listener will walk through timber halls that vanished before Chaucer spoke, hear the crack of gunfire that signaled civil war, breathe coal dust in Victorian laboratories, and feel the cold hum of contemporary GPU clusters. Kings and commoners, saints and heretics, benefactors and radicals will pass in review, each pushing the place toward an identity none of them could fully define. But for now, the choir's final amen hovers above the river. The crowd begins to disperse. Rowers shoulder their boats. A porter sweeps confetti from the cobblestones. All around, lecture rooms and libraries remain locked, poised to open. The day is about to begin, as it has begun here for 900 years, with a simple premise that ideas deserve a roof, a table, and an argument. What those ideas become, creed or code, vaccine or verse, depends on the people who step through the doorway next. End of prologue. RS-684E-595-non-58546-967-NEW, Reasoning. MSG-684E1CE8CO3081A2B251C8C2B639C6738. Message, in progress, output text. Stand for a moment on the low gravel terrace that borders the Thames, the Isis to local boatmen, and picture Oxford in the closing years of the 11th century. A modest market town, clustered round a wooden ford on the Roman road west from London. Livestock scented the air, church bells governed labor, and the nearest center of advanced study lay 100 miles away in Paris. Yet by 1096, according to the medieval Historia Ecclesiae Abingdonensis, organized teaching was already underway here. We do not know the names of those first masters, but their students, clerks preparing for ecclesiastical or royal service, surface in episcopal registers and in the Abingdon Abbey complaint that scholars were hiring horses without permission. Multiple, roughly contemporary documents converge on the same point. Oxford is the oldest continuously operating university in the English-speaking world. Why did scholars gather here? Geography mattered. Oxford lay 2 days' ride from London, yet far enough to escape metropolitan turbulence. The river network linked it through Southampton to continental book markets, while parish churches such as St. Frideswyde's Priory provided liturgical work and lodging. Above all, post-conquest kings needed literate officials, and a gifted lecturer in canon law could earn a living by charging lectio fees, small coins paid directly by students in the master's rented hall. Those halls deserve a quick definition. A domus or aula was simply a house where a master lodged pupils under his supervision. Unlike a college, it lacked a permanent endowment and could vanish when the master moved away. Names such as St. Mary's Hall and Brasenose Hall appear in 12th century deeds, revealing a patchwork of timber tenements adapted for lecture, prayer, and sleep. The system's impermanence belies its importance. It pioneered regulated residence and collective study, two principles that would later underpin Oxford's collegiate identity. Growth rarely follows a straight line. In 1167, King Henry II, locked in conflict with Thomas Becket and wary of French influence, forbade English students to attend the University of Paris. The royal pipe rolls record payments to messengers dispatched with the ban. Conceived as a political maneuver, the edict redirected ambitious scholars back across the channel. Oxford, already functioning, became the obvious beneficiary. Parisian standard texts, Peter Lombard's Sentences, Gratian's Decretum, soon enter Oxford book chests, and a vernacular proverb joked, "Who cannot go to Paris must hie to Oxenford." Henry's decree catalyzed an intellectual critical mass that would prove lasting. With numbers climbing, informal customs hardened into recognizable structures. By the 1180s, masters elected an unofficial magister scholarium to represent them before the Bishop of Lincoln. Scholars claimed benefit of clergy, allowing clerks to be tried in ecclesiastical rather than secular courts. This embryonic autonomy foreshadowed the corporate privileges European universities would later claim. Privilege, however, bred resentment among townspeople, burgesses in contemporary charters. The earliest fatal clash came in 1209. A tavern brawl left a citizen dead. Civic authorities hanged two clerks without waiting for ecclesiastical confirmation of their status. Hundreds of scholars fled, some to Cambridge, sowing the seed of a sister university. Oxford's tax base collapsed, and the Burgesses petitioned King John for reconciliation. Royal Letters Patent of 1214 granted scholars price-regulating powers and confirmed their right to ecclesiastical jurisdiction in civil offenses. The riot had forced royal acknowledgement that the scholar body constituted a legal community, universitas, in its own right. By 1250, visitors approaching the city would have seen stone extensions to St. Fridswides and heard Latin declamations from doorways along School Street. They might not have imagined the Bodleian Library or the Side Business School, yet they would have recognized a civic landscape already shaped by learning. The decisive features, self-governance, legal independence, and an ability to absorb displaced scholars were in place. Oxford's lodgings, though, remained fragile. A single fire or quarrelsome landlord could scatter an entire hall. The solution, the self-governing, perpetually endowed college, emerged through statutes that welded property, piety, and pedagogy into one legal fabric. Walter de Merton's statutes of 1264 founded Merton College on perpetual revenues and required that academic governance rest with resident fellows, establishing the principle that a college is a corporation able to sue and be sued. Balliol followed in 1263, its endowment completed by John de Balliol's widow, Dervergilla of Galloway. Exeter arrived in 1314. Together, they showed how benefaction and statute could create institutions robust enough to outlast their founders. Intellectually, the climate was anything but static. William of Ockham's lectures at the Franciscan House, near the present Botanic Garden, challenged the realist view of universals and refined the logical razor that still bears his name. By the 15th century, humanism flowed in through scholars such as William Grocyn and Thomas Lineker, who brought Greek texts and philological rigor from Florence. Desiderius Erasmus stayed briefly at Queen's College in 1499 to 1500, borrowing Chrysostom from Merton's library and reinforcing his conviction that scripture required textual purity. Architecture echoed the shift. The Divinity School's Leern Rib Vaulting, 1420-1483, embodies scholastic intricacy, while its expansive windows signal Renaissance confidence in light and reason. Books multiplied almost as quickly as ideas. Sir Thomas Bodley, returning from diplomacy in 1598, found the university library utterly forsaken and rebuilt it with personal funds. His 1610 agreement with the Stationers' Company guaranteed Oxford a copy of every book registered for publication, positioning the Bodleian at the heart of Europe's information network when it opened in 1602 with about 6,000 volumes. Yet harmony was fragile. Henry VIII's break with Rome dissolved local monasteries and refounded Cardinal Wolsey's unfinished college as Christ Church, uniquely combining cathedral and college. Merryweather's reign brought the 1555-56 martyrdom of Cranmer and Ridley at the North Gate. Elizabeth I restored moderate Protestantism 2 years later. During the Civil War, Charles I made Oxford his wartime capital, 1642-46. Colleges melted silver plate to coin, and parliamentarian visitors later purged royalist fellows. Amid the turmoil, John Wilkins's Philosophical Club at Wadham nurtured Robert Boyle's air pump experiments, prefiguring the Royal Society, chartered 1662, and demonstrating a methodological turn from scholastic argument to controlled experiment. Restoration projects knitted Baconian curiosity to public display. The Ashmolean Museum opened in 1683, combining cabinet of curiosities, lecture room, and chemical laboratory, the first university museum to do so. The Radcliffe Observatory, begun 1772, gathered astronomical and meteorological data that modern climatologists still consult. Parliamentary reform followed. The 1854 Universities Act ended clerical monopolies and introduced competitive examinations, boosting undergraduate numbers from about 1,500 in 1800 to roughly 3,000 by 1900. Steam power redrew the city. Trains reached Oxford in 1850, doubling the population within 50 years, and weaving the university into national commerce. Scientific controversy burst into view at the 1860 Huxley-Wilberforce debate on Darwin's Origin of Species in the newly built Museum of Natural History. Social reform soon matched intellectual change. Lady Margaret Hall, 1878, and Somerville, 1879, opened collegiate study to women, who finally received full degrees in 1920. Two world wars tested Oxford's resilience. In 1914-18, some 14,500 members served, rolls of honor record 2,716 dead. Somerville became a military hospital, its improvised wards run largely by women still barred from degrees. The Second World War drew researchers to codebreaking at Bletchley and weapons science at the Clarendon Laboratory. 715 university members were killed. Post-war expansion was rapid. Total enrollment rose from 7,000 in 1947 to about 10,200 by 1962, and graduate-only colleges such as Nuffield, 1937, and St. Anthony's, 1950, pushed Oxford decisively into social science and area studies research. Science accelerated. Dorothy Hodgkin's crystallography at Somerville won the 1964 Nobel Prize for her structure of insulin. The computing laboratory opened in 1957 with a Ferranti Mercury computer. Pioneers such as Christopher Strachey and Tony Hoare laid foundations for modern software verification. By 2000, international students comprised nearly a quarter of enrollment. Today they approach half, and gender parity has been reached among undergraduates. That global orientation framed one of the 21st century's most consequential projects. In early 2020, the Jenner Institute pivoted its adenovirus platform to SARS-CoV-2, designing the ADOX1 nCoV-19 vaccine within days of the genome's release. Phase 1 trials launched on the 23rd of April. UK regulatory approval arrived 8 months later, and more than 2 billion doses have since been distributed at cost to lower-income countries. The episode condensed a century-long arc from wartime penicillin to genomic-era vaccinology. Amid such science, Oxford confronted its own history. The Rhodes Must Fall movement pressed for a reckoning with imperial legacies. Oriel College's statue still stands, but scholarships and expanded research into colonial history reflect institutional change. Meanwhile, the university's Mathematical Institute houses GPU clusters for deep learning physics, and the Big Data Institute mines billions of genomic variants for disease correlations. On the site of the former Rewley Road railway terminus, the Said Business School embodies this fusion of heritage and innovation. Wafik Said's 1996 benefaction funded architects Edward Jones and Jeremy Dixon to create interlocking quadrangles in Cotswold stone and glass, opening in 2001 and expanding in 2012. Rather than a silo, the school positions itself as an amplifier of expertise across Oxford. The 1+1 MBA pairs business study with master's programs in fields from African studies to biomedical engineering. The Oxford Man Institute applies machine learning to quantitative finance in partnership with Man Group. The student-run Oxford Seed Fund backs impact-oriented startups, measuring social as well as financial returns. A compulsory Capitalism in Debate course, co-taught by philosophers and economists, pushes students to test shareholder value orthodoxy against capability and climate frameworks. Rankings now list Said among the world leaders for integrating sustainability into management education. Visitors encounter a city that is neither museum nor isolated campus, but a compact ecosystem where medieval cloisters, laboratories, cafes, and lecture halls interlace within a few square miles. Trains from London reach Oxford in under an hour. Drivers are advised to use park-and-ride hubs that feed low-emission buses into the center for a modest daily fare. Walking remains the simplest mode, but cycling is ubiquitous. Collision statistics recommend lights after dusk and caution on narrow streets. Three sites offer an immediate sense of Oxford's intellectual and architectural range. The Bodleian Library's Old Schools Quadrangle, entered on time tours, still observes Bodley's 1600 injunction against open flame. A short walk east rises the University Church of St. Mary the Virgin. Its tower opens early in summer, and rewarding climbers with a citywide panorama. Southwest lies Christ Church, where Evensong is sung daily in term by a cathedral choir fully integrated into college life. Dining surprises those expecting undergraduate austerity. The 18th century covered market houses a bakery famed for buttery Eccles cakes, while Jericho's former iron foundry terraces now offer restaurants ranging from Syrian plates to Cornish-sourced seafood. Formal hall tickets are bookable online at several colleges, arrive promptly, stand for Latin grace, and silence phones until coffee. Oxford's calendar pivots on academic term. In Hillary, January-March, the rivers swell, punting pauses, but winter light turns new college cloisters into a photographer's dream. Trinity term, April-June, brings summer eights rowing, where towpath crowds cheer bumps as boats make contact. On the 1st May at dawn, Magdalen College Choir sings the 500-year-old Hymnus Eucharisticus from the Great Tower. Police close the bridge, and thousands gather in ritual that momentarily pauses modern traffic. Practicalities include weather. Annual rainfall averages 674 millimeters, and security. Violent crime is low, but bicycle theft is common. Sturdy locks and bike register tagging are wise. Under red board flood warnings, meadow paths close and punts are withdrawn, but the Weston Library's free exhibitions provide an indoor refuge. A single day can sketch the essentials. Coffee in the covered market, Christchurch before the coaches arrive, Bodleian tour after noon bells at St. Mary's, Ashmolean galleries before a Jericho supper, Evensong rounding off the evening. 3 days allow cycling to Port Meadow, visiting Blenheim Palace, and exploring the history of Science Museum's Enigma artifacts. Courtesy smooth access. Respect examination closures. Refrain from drones over quads. Photograph chapels only outside services. Colleges are academic residences first, heritage sites second. A brief exchange with a porter earns goodwill that no guidebook can match. Departure seldom ends engagement. Colleges stream chapel music, departments host public webinars, and publications from the Oxford Internet Institute or the Big Data Institute are freely accessible. Those who have stood beneath the Divinity School's fan vault or heard footsteps echo on Merton's mob quad often find themselves following lectures online, adding fresh questions to conversations that began beside candlelit lecterns 9 centuries ago. Across war memorial cloisters and vaccine cold chain logistics, across valve computers and quantum processors, the pattern is clear. Oxford responds to external upheaval, military, technological, epidemiological, by coupling innovation to collegiate identity. That identity, continuously renegotiated, sustains a community where evidence arbitrates disputes and tradition frames new inquiry. Visitors who walk its lanes with informed curiosity become temporary stewards of that conversation, carrying it onward with every question they take home. Thank you for choosing Aster Publishing.